San Francisco. I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Recent congressional testimony by the seven top executives of the nation's leading tobacco companies drew major media attention and public reaction. The suggestion that cigarettes are no more addictive than coffee or tea flies in the face of anyone who has struggled to quit smoking cigarettes and who knows that any triumph they feel from actually quitting can be eradicated in the time it takes to strike a match. As a person who has never smoked, and as a parent, my interest lies more directly in the effects of secondhand smoke. So what interested me most in this testimony was the suggestion that science was in fact inconclusive with regards to the effects of breathing other people's cigarette smoke. Today we'll talk about this aspect of the smoking issue. Dr. Stan Glantz is a professor of medicine at the University of California at San Francisco and a member of the California State Scientific Review Panel on Toxic Air Contaminants. Jim Rapace is a health physicist with the Environmental Protection Agency. In light of the 1992 Environmental Protection Agency's report on the effects of secondhand smoke, I started by asking Jim how long the EPA has been looking at the situation and specifically about the science which it considered.
Well, as you know, the EPA completed a major report in 1992, which said that tobacco smoke causes lung cancer in non-smokers as well as smokers, and it severely harms the health of infants and small children, gives them asthma, bronchitis, pneumonia, and causes their lungs not to grow very well. And as everybody knows, the tobacco industry doesn't accept this. They say that this report is based on bad science, and they say that EPA is full of a cabal of anti-smoking people, and they're just out to stamp out smoking. I thought it would be useful for your audience to know what the genesis of the EPA's interest in tobacco smoke really was, and really how firm the science is upon which this report is based, because I think this story has really never come out. And it goes back, I believe, to 1979 when I joined the Environmental Protection Agency, coming over from the Naval Research Laboratory, where I kept the world safe for ballistic missiles. And then I came over to try to keep the world safe from air pollution. And not long after I arrived there, I got involved in a project with the Department of Energy, a five-day environmental review, and I realized immediately that there was an indoor air pollution impact from this energy conservation program that they were proposing. And so, to make a long story short, we got into negotiations with the Department of Energy, and they asked EPA to set indoor air quality standards. So gradually, I became the only person at EPA to work on this indoor air quality problem. We negotiated with the Department of Energy, and we had a good program going. The early 1980s, as many people will remember, the Reagan administration put a lot of people in the EPA who later were asked to leave, political appointees.
Oh, dear.
There was one, however, who was not, who became the head of air programs, and he was appointed by the President of the United States. Joe Cannon was his name, and he was my second-line supervisor. We were in the air policy office. And so working for a political appointee, I got to do things that most people in EPA never get to do, like get on the radio and television and talk about air pollution and things like that. I was the spokesman for the indoor air program, as informal as it was in those days. Mm-hmm. I also continued research, which I had started in the mid-1970s, on indoor air pollution from tobacco smoke. And one of the things that we were able to show was that tobacco smoke was probably the dominant source of air pollution exposure for non-smokers. And
indoors, obviously.
Indoors, but it dominated all of the air pollution exposures outdoors from the smoke particles in the air. In other words, that was the biggest source of exposure to smoke particles. And so I published that work in 1980. And along about 1984, I was able, with Dr. Al Lowry, to figure out what the risk was, the lung cancer risk from that exposure. And as luck would have it, the work that we did wasn't published, but it came to the attention of the CBS Evening News through some
Somehow.
Strange mechanism, and we were invited to talk about it. About a week later, the New York Times ran a story on it and said there was a big EPA study that said 5,000 people were dying every year from lung cancer. And Joe Cannon, who was the head of air programs at that point, walked into my office after a while and said, we would like EPA to do something about tobacco smoke. It looks like it's a problem. And so he said, here's $75,000. Go and get a study from the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences, which did controversial studies for the government, like on the supersonic transport and effect on of chemicals on the ozone layer and things like this. And, you know, they're an organization of independent scientists who are nationally prominent who do these controversial studies, and they have their prestige as big shots to make it stick, and they don't have any particular interest in what the outcome is. And so I knew $75,000 wasn't enough to get such a study. So I went over to the Department of Health and Human Services and talked to my friend Don Shopland at the Office on Smoking and Health. And I said, Don, do you have any more money? Because it costs about $250,000 to get a study like this. And he was able to come up with it. So the jointly sponsored between the Office of the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the EPA, the National Academy of Sciences, did a study. And the charge that they had was to do, you know, tell us what we know about secondhand smoke and tell us what we need to know about it. And about a year later, they came up with the National Academy of Sciences report on environmental tobacco smoke.
And what year was that?
This was in 1986.
Okay.
And Don Shopland, having invested the lion's share of the money in this report, said, well, the taxpayers ought to get a better bang for their buck than this. We're going to do the 1986 Surgeon General's report on involuntary smoking. So we got two reports for the price of one. And they were both done by independent panels of scientists. The Department of Health and Human Services had its own panel of scientists that did all these Surgeon General's reports. And the amazing thing is that both independent panels of nationally prominent scientists came to the same conclusion, which was that secondhand smoke caused cancer in healthy non-smokers and that it was extremely harmful for the health of young children. So at this point, I went back to the political people at EPA, and the indoor air program had just been formed. I was not its head. We decided we had a very small budget in Washington terms. It was $50,000, and we had three people. And the manager of the program came to me and said, well, Jim, what should we do with such a small budget and so few people? And I said, you know, we have to concentrate on what's really important and try to do all the work in-house. And I said, we'll focus on the things that have very high public health payoff. And what we know about is secondhand smoke is one of those, because we have two reports which tell us it's killing lots of people. And it's also harming the respiratory health of children. And we then went to the deputy administrator of the agency, of EPA, and this was Jim Barnes, and Ruckelshaus was the administrator at that time. And we said, we want to go out and do some public information on environmental tobacco smoke. And it's going to be controversial. We know the industry will attack us, and we want to make sure that we've got the support of the top level of the agency, because if we don't, we're not going to wind up doing anything. We know that. And he looked at us, and he said, go with it. It's important. and you should do this, and just make sure you coordinate what you do with the Department of Health and Human Services, because that was a TERF question.
Yes, yes.
That was really, a lot of people thought that Department of Health and Human Services should do that, a lot of people at EPA. But the tobacco industry had kept calling it environmental tobacco smoke, so we were able to sell that to EPA as really part of its mission.
Sometimes these really political hot potatoes come to the point where the government agencies are saying, no, you take it.
That's right.
You take it. And then at other times, it's like, you want to make sure it's kind of spread around so if it turns out well, everybody can jump on it.
Yeah.
So let's see how that works.
So to continue the story, this was about 1987, and at that point, we decided if EPA was going to come out and make a public statement on environmental tobacco smoke, we could certainly sum up the reports of the Surgeon General and the National Research Council and put out public information, which we did. And we put out a couple of page brochure which explained the results of those reports, but we felt that if EPA was really going to get into this in a big way, which it certainly was justified in doing because 5,000 deaths a year was a lot more than for any other regulated hazardous air pollutant that EPA had jurisdiction over. Typically in the air programs, we had our Office of Research and Development take charge of the risk assessments. And so although I had personally done a risk assessment, I wasn't the normal office that did these things. I wasn't the research office. So we just basically went to the research office and we picked the best person that they had, the one who had done the most important risk assessments, and that was Dr. Stephen Bayard. And he was a biostatistician who had taught at Yale, and he was really very good. And he had done things like dioxin and chromium and arsenic and asbestos, and he really knew this. And for him, this was just the pollutant du jour, so to speak. It was just another pretty face. And
yeah.
So we asked him to do this back in about late 1987.
Now, when you say risk assessment, you're saying what's the risk to an individual?
What is the risk to the population at large? And what is the risk to the most exposed individuals? What is the cancer risk? Because we knew at this point that the cancer risk was what we wanted to focus on. And so Stephen took the report. He contracted pieces of it out to national experts and wrote the rest himself. And later on, Ms. Jennifer Jeannot joined the effort, and she wrote a good piece of the report as well. And it took 2 years to produce a draft. It went to EPA Science Advisory Board. And the Science Advisory Board at EPA, again, is a panel of outside independent experts who are not beholden to EPA for anything. And if they say they don't like what EPA does, which often they do, then we try to accommodate them and do better science or to improve the work that we've done. And so they had some things, critical things to say about the draft report. And they were all experts in fields in which we were not. And so we improved the report. And then 2 more years later, it went back to the Science Advisory Board of these 16 independent outside experts. They unanimously agreed that this was a good report. It was based on sound science, and it was really no different from what earlier organizations had concluded, the Surgeon General, the National Research Council, in the interim, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and the International Agency for Research on Cancer. So we had all of these organizations, plus the EPA, saying this causes cancer, and by the way, it also is extremely harmful for the health of young children. The last part of the report was finalized in 1991. And then in 1992, it was issued to the public, and of course it has had a major national and international impact because people finally realized, with an organization like the EPA says this is bad, it is. So that's really the genesis of the report. And you can see how many layers of scientific review and how many independent government agencies whose scientific effort has all come up to the same thing, that environmental tobacco smoke causes cancer and it's very harmful for the respiratory health of children.
My guests today are Jimmer Pace, physicist with the Environmental Protection Agency, who we've just been listening to, as well as Dr. Stan Glantz, professor of medicine at UC San Francisco. Now, Jim, I'm actually going to stick with you for a while here. What happened when the 1992 report came out?
Well, what happened was the public at large began to realize that this was a big public health problem. And a lot of businesses, for example, immediately went smoke-free, or they restricted smoking in some very severe way. And I think about two-thirds now of American businesses, and these are mostly the larger and intermediate-sized businesses, are basically, for all intents and purposes, smoke-free. That is, they might restrict smoking to a separately ventilated area or
Well, you see people in San Francisco standing outside the
outside building. On the street. Yeah. Well, there's a good reason for that. It's because environmental tobacco smoke is no different than chromium or arsenic or asbestos or radon gas. It causes lung cancer. And it's not something that belongs in the respiratory environment of non-smokers. And moreover, it's a pollutant that you cannot control with ventilation. You know, this is not something, for example, if you were dealing with radioactive gases in the laboratory, you wouldn't just try to use general dilution ventilation to control this. You have to contain it so it never gets at the lungs of the non-smokers.
It's not something to be easily filtered out.
And I think people, that's right, you can't filter it. It's something that you have to control at the source. You just remove the source. And this is what I think EPA is saying, that you either remove people from buildings or you put them in separately ventilated areas that are closed off from the non-smokers' air environment. And very recently, on April 4th, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, has said the same thing. It's proposed a national rule which will ban smoking in workplaces or restrict it to areas which are separately ventilated and under negative pressure with respect to the remainder of the building. So those are the only two options. And the reason that our federal health agencies and occupational health and environmental health agencies are telling us this is because the engineers and scientists have looked at what the control measures are, and these are the only reasonable ones. The others that the tobacco industry says, well, you can put the non-smokers and smokers in separate sections, or you can put the smokers somewhere else on the same ventilation system. That simply doesn't work. It doesn't exclude the toxins and carcinogens in tobacco smoke from the non-smokers' air environment, and therefore it exposes them to unreasonable risk.
Okay, now let me understand what the risk is in this sense. Recently, I was flying through a major airport in the Midwest, going from one place to another place, and had the good fortune to be with someone who belonged to one of those airline clubs.
Right.
And we went in, and it was just a beautiful place, and it had one section that says smoking in this section and no smoking in that section,
right.
A little sign. And the whole place smelled like smoke.
Sure.
But they obviously allowed everyone to continue smoking, and in the bar you could smoke. Will things like that change by law?
Yes, they will. They have changed by law at the volition of many states and localities already. And by national law, they are going to change. And Henry Waxman in Congress has also proposed legislation which will do the same thing at the federal level for all public buildings and workplaces. Whether that gets through the Congress remains to be seen. The tobacco industry has a powerful presence there. But you can see almost everybody that's considered this issue of non-smokers' protection, whether it be at the local level, the state level, the national level, at the federal agency level, they really all come up with the same solution. You have to remove tobacco smoke from the air environment of non-smokers, period. There is no other control measure that works. The tobacco industry basically has not made any credible scientific arguments, and I've looked at them all. I've published papers which analyze the tobacco industry's arguments to see if they had any scientific validity. Other people have done so. In New Zealand, the National Health Department was ordered to ignore the tobacco industry's arguments because they were not found to be scientifically credible. I mean, it's that kind of thing.
Now, the tobacco industry, from what I've read, simply says, well, we haven't seen nothing to convince us. you know, in that sense. And believe me, I'm not saying that I've read everything, but it's like in general, it's like, well, we haven't seen anything to really believe this. I wouldn't want my children to smoke, but I don't really know. At the same time, I do know that there have been accusations of the government studies being biased. When they say it's not good science, what specifically are they saying? Are they just saying that it's not good science, or are they making specific accusations about the scientific studies?
They make, in general, a lot of hand-waving arguments. They say there are uncertainties. They say there are some studies which don't show statistically significant effects. But in fact, if you plot all of the studies of passive smoking and lung cancer on a graph and you look at them in terms of did they find a positive result, a neutral result, or a negative result, there are 32 studies and about 24 of those are positive results. And so it's like if you flip the coin, 32 times and it came up heads 24 times and you would ask yourself, is this a fair coin? You see, no, it isn't a fair coin. There's a real effect here. Some of the studies don't find statistically significant effects, which is the usual scientific test, because they're simply not large enough to detect a statistically significant effect. They don't have enough cases in it to show this. And also because we cannot compare exposed to unexposed, that is, people who are exposed to passive smoking versus people who are not exposed. There aren't any people
Everyone
who are not
exposed
to tobacco smoke. So really what we're doing is we're comparing more exposed people to less exposed people. And to the extent that the control group is much less exposed, we're going to see a statistically significant result. And if they're only a little bit less exposed, we're not going to see it, you see. And this is the thing. So they're focusing on these little nitpicking details, which are only a very small piece of the total weight of evidence. And this is what the federal agencies have looked at. Now, here's a substance which is known to cause cancer in people who expose themselves to large amounts of tobacco smoke. That should have been enough in 1964 to say to the world at large, if it causes cancer and you're going to put it in your air environment, it's going to give you cancer, even if it's at a much lower level. For example, if somebody were saying, here's something that causes cancer, we're going to put it in Coca-Cola, we're going to bake it into bread, we're going to put it in candy that we give to children, would anybody in his right mind allow that? You could never get a product like that on the market. But here we have something which is in the air, you see, which is not so easily controlled because we're not accustomed to standards of quality of indoor air at this point, as we are in outdoor air, in drinking water, and in food. Mm-hmm. As a society, we just haven't quite made that next step into protecting the environment in which we spend 90% of our time, which is the indoors. 5% of the amount of lead that you breathe in is absorbed, that you eat or drink in water is absorbed into your body, but 95% of the same amount of lead that you breathe in a vapor, for example, from automobile exhaust, is absorbed. So the things that you breathe in have much easier access to your bloodstream than that which you eat or drink. And therefore, a little bit of tobacco smoke can go a very long way in creating harm to non-smokers. And this is basically what's going on. It's very simple. The science is very simple. The tobacco industry is simply making a smokescreen to try to confuse the public so it can continue to market its harmful products for a few more years.
It's very important to recognize that the preparation of the EPA report was an open process. The drafts of the report were public documents, were available to the public, including the tobacco industry, to comment on them. And the tobacco industry sent in, through their experts, so-called experts, that they hired, pounds and pounds of criticism and comments. And all of these comments were, in fact, dealt with in the report. I mean, it did slow the process down, but it really strengthened the document because the EPA took every one of the criticisms that the industry could raise and dealt with them and addressed them. And the Science Advisory Board looked at these documents and looked at the industry's arguments and gave them consideration. And in fact, several members of the Science Advisory Board were getting money from cigarette companies through their various front organizations. One member of the Science Advisory Board got over $1 million in grants from Philip Morris. And despite this, the evidence, the scientific evidence, was so compelling that they approved the EPA document. And in fact, Jim mentioned that there were criticisms of the first draft by the Science Advisory Board. It's important to note that most of the criticisms were that it was too weak, that the EPA staff hadn't stated the case against secondhand smoke as strongly as the scientific evidence warranted. So you had in the SAB an outside committee of people which, if anything, you would have expected to have had a pro-tobacco bias because of all the people on there who were getting money from the industry. But the scientific evidence is just so strong that they had no choice but to support the agency position and, in fact, force the agency to take a stronger position. Another thing that was very important about the EPA getting into this issue was that it's the Environmental Protection Agency. And the public has a very different set of attitudes toward environmental risks versus so-called health risks. Most people don't take health risks very seriously, unfortunately. If they did, people would wear seat belts. But people are very concerned about involuntarily exposing themselves to risks and environmental risks. And the fact that the EPA took a position on secondhand smoke really totally transformed the way this issue is perceived by the public, from a health issue, a sort of individual behavior issue, into an environmental issue and a social issue. And that it's impossible to understate the importance of that shift in emphasis away from individual health questions to the area of pollution control and environmental regulation. And to just put this 5,000 deaths in context, benzene, which is very heavily regulated, I think accounts for about 17 deaths a year. Vinyl chloride, which is very heavily regulated, is around 30 deaths a year, I think. And the only other pollutant out there that even approaches secondhand smoke in terms of toxicity is radon, which is a naturally occurring substance. And most environmental toxins, benzene, as non-occupational exposure to asbestos, vinyl chloride, arsenic, other class A carcinogens, account for 50 or less deaths a year from cancer, whereas secondhand smoke from lung cancer alone, and we'll talk about heart disease in a minute, but lung cancer alone is, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 deaths.
For direct cigarette smoking, if I am a smoker, how many deaths a year is that?
There's about 420,000 deaths a year from smoking among smokers, and about 53,000 deaths from passive smoking among non-smokers. So when you add it all together, the tobacco industry kills nearly 500,000 Americans every year. And the to put that into some context, illegal drugs, which this country is proposing to spend $13 billion fighting, kills about 10 to 20,000 people a year. And that includes people who overdose, people who get gorked out and drive into a brick wall, drug-related crime, everything. So we're spending $13 billion to try to stamp out illegal drugs, which kill maybe 15,000 people. Tobacco kills 500,000 people, which is what? 35 times as many, and the government's going to spend maybe $100 million a year on tobacco. And it's like the priorities, the spending priorities of the government are absolutely backwards. Now, I'm not saying illegal drugs are a good thing. They're not. But as a public health problem compared to tobacco, they're a very small problem. And the federal government, because of the political power of the tobacco industry, has simply ignored the leading public health problem of our time. You know, sure, they put out the Surgeon General's reports. Those are good. The EPA risk assessment on lung cancer and passive smoking, it was probably the most important government document on tobacco since the original 1964 Surgeon General's report. But the overall government level of government commitment and action to control tobacco is pathetic when you compare it with the size of the problem and the fact that, in fact, we do know how to control the problem of tobacco.
Now, Stan, let me ask you this. I think many people will have a reaction that says, Oh, the 5,000 deaths from secondhand smoke. That must be people who are living in a house with a person who's really smoking it up. It can't be me because nobody smokes at my house. I go in and out of stores. I go to the airport lounge. Is that true?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's no safe level of exposure to the 43 carcinogens in secondhand smoke. And any exposure is bad. But there's also what's called a dose-response relationship, and the more exposure you get, the worse it is. So someone who works in a smoky environment, who lives with smokers...
Who
hangs out in bars, that kind of person is going to be at much higher risk of developing lung cancer or heart disease or the other diseases associated with secondhand smoke than someone like me who doesn't live with any smokers, who works in a smoke-free workplace, who lives here in San Francisco where you can pretty much go about your business without encountering much secondhand smoke at all. So if you only get an occasional exposure, that's not as bad as heavy exposures. But, you know, it's like saying, well, a little bit of a carcinogen, don't mind. You know, it's if you're just getting a little bit poisoned, we shouldn't do anything about it. And the fact is, unlike some environmental toxins, which are very hard to deal with, very expensive to deal with, it's very easy to deal with passive smoking. You simply move the smokers outside away from the air intakes for the building. And, in terms of outdoor air pollution, it's not much of a problem at all. So you just move the smoking out of doors. Or you could set up separately ventilated smoking lounges, as the EPA and OSHA have suggested, as long as they're not hooked up to the building ventilation. Because if you have just a non-smoking section or even a separate room for the smokers, if it's on the common building ventilation, some of the stuff does in fact settle out because there are some of the larger particles in the smoke settle out locally. But the gases and the small particles get entrained in the air and circulated through the building. And secondhand smoke is so toxic. I mean, it's hundreds to thousands of times more toxic than most other pollutants. Even a little bit of it getting and being circulated through the building system is enough to produce cancer risks and heart disease risks that are way above what would be considered acceptable in outdoor air. And to give you an idea, at University of California, San Francisco, where I teach, we've been a smoke-free workplace for about 4 years now. And that's been enough time for all of the nicotine and tar particles that had settled out in the building ventilation to pretty much get blown out. So it's pretty clean in there. And the University Medical Center is up on a very windy hill here in San Francisco. One day I was walking up the hill to work on this windy street, and they're putting a no smoking sign up on the outside of the building. And I thought, well, this is sort of strange. There weren't even any doors right near there. Why are they putting a no smoking sign up out in front of a building on a windy street? Well, it turned out that it was right near the air intake systems for the hospital. And people were standing out there and smoking. And despite the fact that there was a stiff crosswind, enough pollution was getting sucked into the building ventilation that people were complaining inside the building. Nobody knew where it was coming from. I mean, the buildings and grounds people had to track it down. But enough was being drawn in that people were feeling badly. Yeah, because what happens, your body is a very adaptable thing. And you get used to certain things, and sort of your brain kind of tunes them out, and you don't notice that they're there if they're always there. And when people then get into environments where they aren't chronically subjected to secondhand smoke, they really start noticing it because it's a very, very potent toxin and a very potent pollutant. And a lot of people have said to me, you know, I used to never even complain about secondhand smoke. I didn't know about it. It didn't bother me. But now that I'm working in a smoke-free environment, it really bothers me. And that's because their nose has literally retuned itself and is now saying to their brain, this stuff is there. Whereas before, it used to just sort of say, well, it's always there, so there's no reason sending any nerve traffic up to your brain about it.
You're listening to TechNation, Americans in Technology. My guest today is Jim Rapace, physicist, a health physicist with the Environmental Protection Agency, and Dr. Stan Glantz, professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco. Now, we've been talking about cancer, and you were mentioning cardiology. Let me tell you an experience I had, and you tell me if this is related. I remember I had a college roommate, and we went to Europe once together. And she was actually in another suite, you know, but this was the first time we actually lived together. And she was a real smoker. And what we would do is every night before, you know, we'd get in our, you know, twin beds in those little European hotel rooms, and she would have one last cigarette. And she'd put it out, and we'd turn the light off, and I'd be exhausted, ready to go to sleep. And my heart would start racing. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. Do you think that? I thought it was the smoke. But
It is. In fact, all of the attention at the EPA so far has been on respiratory effects. But it turns out, if you look at the total public health burden of secondhand smoke, heart disease is the big effect. There's about 3,000 to 5,000 lung cancer deaths a year due to heart or passive smoking and lung cancer. There's about 30,000 to 40,000 deaths a year due to heart disease caused by secondhand smoke. And secondhand smoke does a whole lot of different things to the heart, and as does active smoking. Some of the effects are long-term effects, like with cancer. Long-term exposure to secondhand smoke increases the chances you'll get heart disease, that your arteries will get clogged up, things like that. But there's also a lot of immediate short-term effects, and one of them is increase in pulse rate. I mean, the toxins in the smoke act on the heart in a way to increase blood pressure, to increase heart rate. And the effects that you were seeing were almost certainly due to the secondhand smoke. Many of the effects of smoking and passive smoking on the heart are due to the immediate acute effects. It's the immediate poisoning. For example, there's a lot of carbon monoxide in secondhand smoke. That's the colorless, odorless poison gas that's in auto exhaust. When people lock themselves in the garage with the engine running to commit suicide, it's the carbon monoxide that kills them. And what carbon monoxide does is it binds to blood in place of oxygen and reduces the ability of blood to carry oxygen. And your heart needs a lot of oxygen, as does your brain. And so one reason people get headaches in parking garages sometimes is this carbon monoxide. Well, one reason people get headaches when they're around secondhand smoke is the carbon monoxide is reducing the amount of oxygen to their brain and also to their heart. Another thing that it does is it speeds up your heart and it increases your blood pressure by making your blood vessels get smaller. And that increases the workload that your heart has to do and also makes it harder to get blood to your heart and to service the heart muscle. In addition, the ability of the heart muscle to take oxygen and turn it into the energy molecule, which is called ATP or adenosine triphosphate, is inhibited very quickly. Studies that have been done with rabbits have shown that 10 minutes of breathing secondhand smoke cuts the efficiency with which heart muscle converts oxygen into the energy molecule by almost a third. So that oxygen that's getting to your heart isn't used as effectively. In addition, there's changes in your blood chemistry that occur with secondhand smoke exposure. There are elements in your blood called platelets, which help your blood clot. And it's very important when you cut yourself that your platelets get sticky. But if they get sticky when they're not supposed to, that can cause a little blood clot, which if it lodges in your brain is called a stroke, or if it lodges in your heart, it's called a heart attack. And also the activated platelets damage the lining of the coronary arteries, and the lining of damaging the lining is the first step toward getting heart disease. So there's a whole lot of effects of secondhand smoke on the heart. And in fact, I think the evidence that secondhand smoke hurts the heart is newer than the lung cancer evidence. The lung cancer evidence has been around since about 1980, whereas the heart disease evidence really started appearing in about 1985 or 86. If you go back and read the Surgeon General's report or the National Academy report that Jim was talking about, both of them say, well, there's some evidence that secondhand smoke may have something to do with heart disease, but it's too early to tell. And the tobacco industry loves quoting those documents. Those were true statements in 1985 or 86. It was too early to tell.
There was not enough information.
Yeah.
It's not that all the information is in and we'll just never know.
Right.
It's like it's early in the research
That's
cycle.
Right. It was very early in the research cycle. Well, that was, 7, 8 years ago. And now we know a lot more than we did before. And the studies, the epidemiological studies on heart disease are even more consistent than the lung cancer studies are. Of all of the studies I've reviewed, every single one of them showed an elevation in heart disease risk among non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke, except for the one the tobacco industry funded. And the oddly enough, which actually showed it was protective. The other thing we have with heart disease, when you're dealing with lung cancer, you have the population studies showing an elevation in risk of non-smokers married to smokers, an elevated risk of lung cancer. And we know that that cigarette smoke is carcinogenic. I mean, that's the basic case. With heart disease, in addition to the population studies, because many of the effects of passive smoking on the heart occur very quickly, you can actually do clinical studies and laboratory studies and show effects. So, for example, if you take a healthy person and put them on a treadmill and exercise them, and then do it again after they've been exposed to secondhand smoke, they can't exercise as well because of these effects on the heart of reducing the amount of oxygen and the efficiency with which the heart processes oxygen, and that ends up with them not being able to exercise as much. If you look at their blood chemistry, their platelet stickiness changes very quickly. A non-smoker who breathing secondhand smoke for a half an hour has platelets that are almost as sticky as a habitual smoker. And then there's animal studies. We've done a study where we exposed rabbits to secondhand smoke for 6 hours a day, 5 days a week for 10 weeks in a concentration about like a smoky bar. And we doubled the amount of fatty deposits in their arteries. Now, that's the first step in getting heart disease, is how these fat deposits. We have another study that was just published in the March issue of Circulation, which showed that rats who breathed secondhand smoke for anywhere from 18 hours up to 90 hours, and then we induced a little heart attack by blocking a coronary artery or a heart artery in these rats, that the more secondhand smoke they breathed, the worse the heart attack was. So you could, what this is saying is you could have someone who had never smoked, had never breathed secondhand smoke, and who just developed heart disease because of a bad family history or eating too much ice cream and being sedentary, and then they started working in a smoky environment for as little as a few weeks and then had a heart attack. That heart attack is going to be worse because of these relatively short-term secondhand smoke exposures. So the heart disease data is very, very important because it really ups the ante. When you add up the heart disease, the lung cancer, nasal cancers, cervical cancers, other places that secondhand smoke has been shown to cause cancer, you end up with about 53,000 deaths a year, which makes passive smoking the third leading preventable cause of death in this country after active smoking, which is about 420,000 deaths, and alcohol, which is about 106. Passive smoking beats out suicides, it beats out accidents, it beats out homicides, it beats out AIDS, it beats out illegal drugs. Passive smoking kills 4 or 5 times as many people as illegal drugs do. And yet the government is just beginning to deal with the problem.
So if I'm getting the picture correctly, the amount of evidence from research about what is the effects, how big are the effects, it's the crest of the wave is coming.
Oh, yeah. I would say if you look at the scientific evidence on passive smoking, it's overwhelming, and especially if you compare it to any other environmental toxin. I sit on the California State Scientific Review Panel on Toxic Air Contaminants, and we're like the state version of the EPA Science Advisory Board, and we're put in the position of asking, is there enough evidence to warrant having the state regulate a given compound. We're meeting tomorrow to talk about benzoapyrene, which is in secondhand smoke, in fact. But typically, when you're dealing with an environmental toxin, you're either looking at animal studies and having to extrapolate to humans, or you're looking at people who are exposed to very high doses of the toxin at the workplace, and you're trying to extrapolate to very low dose exposures in the population as a whole. When you look at secondhand smoke, that's not the problem at all. What you have with secondhand smoke is most of the data is from real population exposures of real people. There's no extrapolations necessary. You don't have to extrapolate and decide whether rats are more like people or pigs are more like people or rabbits are more like people. No, you laugh, but that's the kind of questions that you very often have to deal with when you're trying to do environmental toxicology.
Right.
And so it's just when the people I know at both the EPA and the California Environmental Protection Agency who deal with toxic air contaminants look at the evidence on secondhand smoke, it's an open and shut case. None of the problems you typically have to deal with when you're dealing with environmental toxins exist. Now, there is one big problem you have to deal with, and that's the tobacco companies, because the tobacco companies have a lot of money, and they know that as more and more people come to appreciate how dangerous secondhand smoke is to their friends, to their family, to their kids, they're going to not smoke as much. They're going to quit smoking, and that's going to cost the tobacco industry just buckets and buckets of money.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. My guests today are Dr. Stan Glantz, professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and Jim Rapace, a health physicist with the Environmental Protection Agency. Well, normally at this point, somebody will say, well, what can I do to protect myself? But I want to carry on with that point you just made. Let's say I'm a smoker. What do I do? How do I continue my habit so that I don't hurt anybody else?
Well, that's exactly the question a lot of smokers are asking. But, you know, everybody has bad habits. You know, I eat too much ice cream, and I'll cop to that. And, and you know, so if somebody wants to smoke and they do that in a way that doesn't hurt anybody else, you know, everybody
has.
How
do they do it?
Well, they do it by smoking outdoors away from other people.
So not
they
inside
don't,
their
they
home.
They don't smoke inside their home. They don't smoke at their workplace. They go away from where everyone else is. And that's happening. Here in California, almost a third of the households occupied by adult smokers are now smoke-free. And if there are small children present, it's almost half. And I think the EPA report contributed quite a lot to that, because I have a daughter who's just turned 13, and one of her friends' mother, right after the EPA report came out, I happened to be in a social situation, and she knew I was interested in tobacco, and said, gee, what do you think of this EPA report? Do you think that they're right, that my smoking is causing my daughter's asthma? And I said, yes. I mean, it is. The EPA risk assessment on passive smoking is one of the best scientific documents that I've ever seen, and very thoroughly done, thoroughly vetted by the tobacco industry. And, I mean, they ended up producing a wonderful document. And so what this woman did, I just bumped into her again a few months later, and she said, you know, I don't smoke in my house anymore. When I need a cigarette, I go out in the backyard because I don't want to hurt my daughter. I mean, and that's good for her because she's smoking less. It's good for her daughter because her daughter isn't getting poisoned. It's bad for the cigarette companies because every cigarette she doesn't smoke, that's money they don't make. And as people smoke less, it moves them toward quitting. And then that's lots of money the tobacco companies don't make. So the industry is out here talking about freedom and rights and scientific integrity, but it's all really about cash. Because most smokers don't like smoking. Most smokers have tried to quit. Most smokers would like to quit. And the creation of smoke-free environments helps them do that. That's why most smokers, in fact, support smoke-free environments. That and I think a concern that their habit shouldn't put them in the position of harming other people.
You know, we're used to, and from a technology stance, if you are a company that's producing those old wall phones, remember the cranks, and you held one thing up, and that's all you produce. Today, you'd say, we might have a little antique reproduction market here, but we know this is, we used to sell a lot more of these, but we're not going to get in on the industry now. This is just, it's over with. This deal is over with. It's very difficult when your product isn't quite a technology thing to say, gee, can we hang in there a different way? It's over with. If we could find something really productive to do with the same amount of tobacco you grow and go and sell it in a different form, that would be wonderful.
Well, what they are, the different form is Asia, the former Soviet Union.
Well, it's the same form but new market.
Yeah, and so what they're doing is they're losing their market here in the United States and in most of the Western countries. They are invading Eastern Europe and Asia with a vengeance. The largest cigarette factory in the world is a R.J. Reynolds plant in China. The American tobacco companies have gone into Eastern Europe and bought up all the inefficient government tobacco monopolies and are now efficiently selling and advertising cigarettes. Smoking rates among children are skyrocketing. That's where the biggest problem is. I think here in the United States, where there's work to be done, there's no question that there's work to be done, we are well on our way to seeing a smoke-free society. I mean, here in California, where we have an active anti-tobacco program because of a tobacco tax initiative passed by the voters, we could effectively eliminate tobacco use in the state within another 3 or 4 or 5 years by simply beating the cigarette companies at their own game in terms of counter-advertising and counter-sponsorship of community events. At the federal level, with the movement toward OSHA doing something, with Congressman Waxman's bill, with other activities by the federal government, there's no reason that the successes here couldn't be copied. And, I think that tobacco as a cause of disease could essentially be eliminated in 10 years in this country. What you just want to do is create an environment where nobody wants the stuff. You can, with an appropriate, aggressive anti-tobacco education program, counter the messages being put forth by the tobacco industry. It all comes down to whether there's the political will to take on the industry. And at the federal level, there hasn't been. At the state level, there really hasn't been. But what's happened is the evidence that passive smoking is dangerous has continued to snowball. More and more communities have passed local laws creating smoke-free workplaces and smoke-free public places. And if you look at the whole evolution of the tobacco issue over the last few years, and I've been involved in this almost as long as Jim has. I got in it in 1978. This is a place where democracy has worked, where the people have taken this issue into their own hands at the local level. The people have read the science, and the people understand it and have acted appropriately.
You raised a question I don't think I know what to do about. I'm an American. I live in the United States. I can see this whole thing happening, but now I'm a citizen of the world, and I'm seeing this go out, as you're describing, into Asia, into all of these populations. It's not something that we all want to see humans do. We know it's bad. What can I do, sitting here in the United States, to contribute to that success?
Well, I think the first thing you can do is go to President Clinton and say, the United States government should not be aggressively promoting tobacco overseas. Under the Reagan and Bush administrations, the United States used the Foreign Trade Representative to force many other countries to repeal their local tobacco control laws, restrictions on advertising, and forced American cigarettes into other countries. In Japan, it used to be illegal to advertise cigarettes on television, thanks to the United States threatening to retaliate against Japanese auto manufacturers. Cigarettes are now the second most advertised product on television in Japan, and cigarette smoking among children is skyrocketing.
So it's a federal foreign policy change.
Yes, and Clinton has appointed Mickey Cantor his foreign trade representative. Well, Mickey Cantor was the tobacco industry's big Democratic power lawyer in California for years. Mickey Cantor more or less single-handedly prevented Los Angeles from adopting a local tobacco control ordinance for years, and now he's the guy who's in charge of our foreign trade policy. And I think people need to say to Clinton, even on the internet, you can write to President Clinton. It's White House.
President at whitehouse.gov.
Yes.
G-O-V.
Yes. And tell him that the U.S. Foreign Trade Representative should not be promoting tobacco. There, we can put export taxes on cigarettes to make it less desirable in these other countries. We can force them to put the same kind of warnings on cigarettes in other countries that we do. There are many, many things that the American country could do to reduce the just scandalous promotion of cigarettes overseas. Former Surgeon General Koop one time said the American tobacco industry kills a lot more Colombians than the Medellin cartel kills Americans.
Have either one of you or both of you had any personal effects from this situation?
Well, being a federal worker, I've had to bear the brunt of tobacco state congressmen's attempts to try to remove me from my job. Yes.
How about you,
Sam? Yes, the tobacco industry attacks me personally in their publications. They've written various people allied with the industry have written letters to everybody from my department chairman to the president of the university demanding I be fired. My grants have been subjected to Freedom of Information Act requests. But, you know, they're losing. I mean, if they want to waste their lawyers' time doing that, that's okay.
Goes with the territory.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
My guests today have been Jim Rapace, a health physicist with the Environmental Protection Agency, and Dr. Stan Glantz, a member of the California State Scientific Review Panel on Toxic Air Contaminants. I spoke with them at KALW-FM in San Francisco. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called Through the Eyes of a Child.
In our daily lives, most of us take the commonplace for granted. When a child asks why the sky is blue or wheels around, the innocence of the question reminds us that such everyday phenomena actually need explanations. How extraordinary we would find it if we woke up one morning to find a green sky, yet the fact of its blueness rarely gives us a second thought. As anthropologist Ruth Benedict succinctly observed, the fish is the last to see the water. Our inability to notice what is before our eyes is celebrated in Edgar Allan Poe's famous short story, The Purloined Letter. In the story, the letter in question was hidden so elegantly that searches in all the expected hiding places, hollow chair legs, secret panels, linings of books, turned up nothing. Only when the story's hero considered an unexpected hiding place, that is, in full view above the fireplace, did the search succeed. Sky is blue, leaves are green, ice floats, things fall down. These are examples of natural phenomena that we tend to take for granted. Cultural phenomena, on the other hand, are readily noted by those outside of the culture. Coming to North America from Britain, for instance, I found it curious at first that Americans drove on the wrong side of the road and installed their light switches upside down. Now, when I return there after living here for over 20 years, it feels odd that Britons drive on the left and push light switches down to turn them on. Reading and writing have a host of cultural biases attached to them. Someone from China or Japan would find reading horizontally across instead of vertically down the page to be strange on first contact. And a Hebrew reader would initially find the European and North American custom of writing from left to right quite weird compared with their opposite convention. For that matter, why do our books open on the right side? And since we all know how much easier it is to thumb through a book from back to front, why don't our books start at the back and end at the front as they do in some Asian cultures? I invite you to stop whatever you're doing right now and become aware of some natural phenomena. Feel gravity inexorably pulling you down towards the center of the earth. Notice your breath calmly supplying your lungs with oxygen about 10 times a minute. That's about 600 breaths since you started listening to this edition of Tech Nation. While your heart has quietly and uncomplainedly pumped about 100,000 times since this time yesterday. And appreciate that the sound from your radio is reaching your eardrum courtesy of the ocean of atmosphere in which we live. No air, no sound. What else, I wonder, are we taking for granted right now because it's so commonplace? We could do worse than ask a young child.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.